After 24 years on the air, Oprah Winfrey announced on Friday she would end her show, The Oprah Winfrey Show, in September of 2011.
After much prayer and months of careful thought, I've decided that next season, season 25, will be the last season of The Oprah Winfrey Show. These years with you, our viewers, have enriched my life beyond all measure.
There are few talk show hosts who've interviewed as many big-name actors, authors, and political dignitaries. Oprah's talked to them all. And this got us thinking about who might be chosen as the guest on Oprah's very last show. Never mind, it's almost 2 years away. For ideas, we've called Chicago Now blogger and WGN-TV reporter Marcus Leshock. On his blog, The Leshock Value, he lists some 20 or so contenders for this final guest chair. And he joins us now. Marcus, welcome.
Hello, Jennifer.
So in your blog, you take the attitude that it's never too early to speculate about something like this.
No, of course not, especially not on the internet. Yeah, I finally have stopped crying here in Chicago. So many people are so upset about this. We were just talking about this in our newsroom. Could any other person ever on television announce that they were going to retire in 2 years and it'd be like front page news? It's unbelievable.
So looking ahead then, give us some of your contenders. Who might be that big time last guest on Oprah?
Well, you know, I started the list just looking at people who have been on Oprah frequently. Somebody like Chris Rock, I believe, is the in the lead with 11 times being on her show. Others like Jim Carrey, Julia Roberts, people who might have been more popular about 10 years ago. But from the people who have been on there very frequently, one of my favorite guests is Will Smith. Anytime he's on the Oprah show, something wild happens. Doesn't matter if whatever he's promoting is garbage or anything like that. But whenever Will's on, it seems to be a very exciting show. He could be a fun last guest.
Well, I think we have a clip of one of his appearances there. Will Smith was a guest on the show in November of last year. Here's just after the election of President Obama.
The Chicago Sun-Times that just had the picture of him, and it had the only headline was Mr. President.
Wow.
I saw that. Just saying it now makes me a little...
Oprah, I'm not going to be... I'm an action hero. I can't be crying on your show.
I know. Did you cry?
I won't be crying at stuff, Oprah. But listen.
I was crying. I was...
Okay, so Will Smith can go on Oprah and cry there. Maybe he doesn't do that anywhere else. What's a number two pick?
A number two pick, of course, if we want to keep it on the celebrity front, Tom Cruise. How about ruining another couch on the Oprah Winfrey set?
She's probably got another one ready for him there.
I'm sure she like snaps her fingers and a couch just appears out of nowhere, Oprah Winfrey. But that appearance had to be one of the most bizarre and captivating appearances ever on television.
And this is, of course, when Tom Cruise declared his love for the lady who would become his wife, Katie Holmes. And let's relive a bit of the moment here.
We've never seen you behave this way before.
I know.
Have you ever felt this way before?
So maybe she'll get some more jumping around there. What about, let's go for a third. What's pick number three?
One for me, I would be very interested to hear from Mr. Stedman Graham. Are you familiar with who Stedman is?
I'm not.
Well, Stedman is Oprah's longtime boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
Who has lurked behind the scenes of this whole mess over the last 25 years or so. I'd love to see him get up there on the stage and tell us some tales. I'm sure he has plenty of things to talk about what it's like to date Oprah.
And see if she can get him to get as personal as some of the other folks.
There you go. And another one that's a personal favorite of mine, I would love this to happen, being a longtime Chicagoan, Roger Ebert, the film critic, of course, of Siskel and Ebert back in the day. About 25 years ago, Roger Ebert went on a date with Oprah Winfrey, and he convinced her to go into syndication. It's a very interesting connection to Chicago luminaries. To see him up on that stage, especially with all of the problems he's going through now with the cancer that he's fighting, it'd be very fitting, especially from a Chicagoan's point of view, to see those two up there and just talk about their life together. So many people don't know about that.
Kind of bringing it full circle then, if he helped her launch.
Yeah.
This last show is, am I correct, it's supposed to be in September of...
2011.
You
don't have it circled on your calendar yet? I was joking earlier, the Mayans were only 1 year off. The world will end in 2011 now because Oprah won't be on TV. There'll be no reason to live anymore.
Okay, well, it will still be a year before the next presidential election. But am I crazy to think that Oprah, who kind of broke precedent here by coming out and stumping for president, now President Obama, you think she's going to go for that big of a get?
Oh, I think for sure. And I think Obama would be foolish to turn her down. She did so much for him, campaigning for him back in the election there, that that was my pick for the obvious choice to have both Barack Obama and Michelle Obama come out on the show, and they can all raise their hands together and help him get to the White House again. Some other people were saying maybe Sarah Palin once again will make an appearance because she might be running for president then. I don't think Oprah will have her on in 2011 like she had the other day. So,
well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Marcus Leshock is a feature reporter at WGN-TV and a blogger at Chicago Now. His blog is called The Leshock Value, and he joined us from Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. Two topics we've just heard about today, illegal immigration and health care, are among the hottest of hot-button political issues. Attempts at a level-headed, fact-based discussion can easily be taken over by passionate emotions on either side. So why is that? Drew Weston is an Emory University professor of psychology and author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. He joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jennifer.
So, Professor Weston, how does our brain process political messages?
Well, you know, it's interesting to listen to the discussion we've just heard, because what you tend to hear from the right are powerful emotional phrases, and what you tend to hear from the left are rational discussions. And our brains really evolved to first hear the emotional side and second to think about it. And really, in many ways, for good reasons, because, you know, when you're when humans were evolving, if you see a snake, if you stop and say, well, let me see, what genus and species is that? You're probably dead. And if you respond first to the emotion, oh, as a snake, you jump away from it.
So does that mean the right always has an advantage, or whoever is using the most emotion in its debate? I mean, on illegal immigration, for example.
Well, you know, our brains evolve to integrate reason and emotion, but the right does have an advantage because they understand that that these issues are emotional issues, and Democrats and the left keep returning to them as rational issues. I mean, a great example being the safety issue with immigration. You can't get to that. You don't want to even talk about that safety issue if you're a proponent of rights for illegal immigrants. If you start from the point of view of let's talk about this as a safety issue, you first have to allay people's concerns about the illegal immigrants we have in this country first. And you'll notice it was not an accident that your guests who were coming from the right, Ira Melman was a great example of this. He never failed to use terms like illegal aliens, which turns people into, you know, some mutant variant of ET.
The undocumented immigrant worker that the left would favor.
Absolutely. And in fact, actually, that's a great one. Here's one where you can probably get away with undocumented workers on NPR. But in general, I've actually polled this, is that it turns out that undocumented workers is actually a worse phrase to use if you want to advance the cause of doing something progressive or reasonable for the 12 million illegal immigrants we have in this country now, because people hear that as a euphemism, or they hear, when they hear undocumented, where their mind goes to is, well, a bunch of them do have documents. What kind of documents are they? They're forged documents.
Uh-huh.
And people are a lot more bothered by the idea of forgery than they are about people coming over the border to try to to try to feed their kids.
Isn't that interesting? Let's move to healthcare now. We should note you have consulted with Georgia's state Democratic Party, but a lot of the opposition to healthcare overhaul has been from Republicans. We've had raucous town hall meetings and Tea Party demonstrations. How do you analyze the Republican strategy on healthcare?
Well, the Republican strategy was clear. I actually did I led up the messaging efforts for some nonpartisan groups back during and immediately before the presidential election. And the messaging strategy for the Republicans was clear back then what it was going to be, which is, and you heard it actually from the Republican congresswoman who I think we heard on before, who talked about rationing and a bureaucrat coming between you and your physician. It's basically to tell a very, very simple story, which is that what Democrats really want is to step in between you and your doctor because they fundamentally don't believe in the free market, and they fundamentally believe that some bureaucrat in Washington knows better than you do how to spend your health care dollars and what kind of decisions you should make. It's a really, really simple but, frankly, emotionally very compelling argument.
Now, what about, just briefly, the argument that President Obama over on the Democratic side somehow just can't get emotional enough about selling health care?
It's absolutely right. I mean, the only way that you can get people – I mean, this is inherently an emotional issue because it touches all of us. But part of the problem is that when you're trying to talk about an issue like this, you really have to tell a story the way the Republicans do, which is a story that has antagonists, that has protagonists. It's the kind of story that our brains really evolved to hear.
And okay.
the president does not like to have antagonists in his stories.
Professor Drew Weston, you're going to stick with us a few minutes more, but we're going to take a short break right now. Professor Weston is author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, the latest wave of immigration, not from Latin America, but to it. That story in a few moments. First, though, we continue our discussion of emotion as a political force. Our guest is Emory University psychology professor Drew Weston. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. And, Professor, thanks for staying with us.
Happy to be here.
Now, on Friday, President Obama's approval rating for the first time dropped below 50% as measured by Gallup. In her Sunday New York Times column, Maureen Dowd suggested that President Obama could learn a thing or two from Sarah Palin on how to be more visceral and connect with voters on a gut level. It sounds like you might agree.
Well, actually, I'd go back a little further than Sarah Palin, probably back to FDR, who had the most similar circumstances to President Obama. I mean, what FDR did in a case like this when he was facing one industry after another that was really fleecing the American public, he said to them, and he said quite famously, you know, at no time in our history, in the history of this country, have so many powerful special interests focused their hatred on one man. And I welcome their hatred. And what he did then was to go on and to say, systematically, he went through and he went after every one of those industries that were endangering the financial security of Americans. He built a WPA, a work program, so that people could go back to work or out of work. And he minced no words about this being Hoover's depression. It was the Republicans' depression. It was the depression that came from unregulated greed. And President Obama just will not do that. He will not blame the recession or this great recession on anyone.
Though his critics claim that he keeps doing that and is doing it for too long, and people are starting to now associate the recession with him.
Well, they're associating the recession with him because he never mentioned from the start that this was a recession that he inherited. You know, he has actually never once uttered the name George Bush since he's been president. And only on three or four occasions has he said, I inherited this, guys. And this was something that I actually wrote about in the first week of his presidency. arguing that he was going to have a failed presidency if he didn't start branding this this recession as the recession caused by Bush and the Republicans, as caused by a philosophy of unregulated greed, and that if he didn't start talking about why we needed deficit spending right now, because otherwise he was going to get stuck with a $1.2 trillion deficit that he was left with. It was going to get blamed on him. And just in terms of strategies for that, FDR played offense on that. So he went right after the bankers. He ran 4 times in a row against Hoover.
And yet we have President Obama, who really ran on the fact that he could rise above this conflict. So you're saying instead of rising above, he needs to kind of wallow in it and play it up?
I think what he'd like to do is to not have the conflict at all and to stay out of it. And the problem is that if you're going to run on reform, if you're going to say we need big changes, you have to do 2 things from an emotional standpoint. The first is you have to make people concerned about what the current situation is, which they sure were back in January, and you have to make them angry towards the people who caused it. If you don't do those 2 things and then follow it with your message of hope, what's going to happen to you is what has happened to President Obama, which is people are now, are now blaming the recession on him. They're basically saying, hey, you broke this. You broke this. You own it.
All right. Drew Weston is Emory University professor of psychology. He's also the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation, and joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. During this recession, many companies took an unusual step to save money: pay cuts. Normally, employers are reluctant to touch wages, worried it might demoralize workers. But this downturn was so bad, they were desperate for extra ways to shrink costs. For some businesses, that meant furloughs or fewer work hours. Others reduced wages. As NPR's Brian Reed reports, many of those companies are now concerned about hanging on to their employees.
Justin Gilmore is on the verge of leaving a job he loves.
I just knew. I'm one of those lucky guys that just know what they want to do when they grow up.
He's an airplane pilot, which means his idea of commuting is a bit different than most people's. He lives with his wife in Burlington, Kentucky, but he had no problem hopping over one morning to meet me in New York. We're at a hotel near LaGuardia Airport.
You come into your same office every day, 5 days a week, and I do too, coming to my same office, but mine moves and has awesome view.
Gilmore's been flying for as long as he can remember. His dad was a pilot, and as a kid he tagged along in the cockpit. Now he flies for Comair, a connecting service for Delta. He's been there almost 10 years, started as a first officer and worked his way up to captain. Then the recession hit. The airline downgraded about 150 captains back to first officer. Gilmore was one of them. His pay was cut from $67 to $42 an hour. Plus, he's working fewer hours. Now his wife brings home their primary paycheck.
It puts a lot more pressure on her to make a certain amount of money. I love the aviation industry. I love flying. I don't want to quit, but I might have to, just for the sake of my family.
Would it be okay if I maybe called her at some point to see how she feels about all this?
Sure, yeah. She works a lot, so it'll be kind of tough to get a hold of her, but...
Good afternoon, this is Becky.
Becky Gilmore is an accountant. She talked to me from her office, where she's been spending a lot of time lately. She says they're really struggling to pay their bills.
We're about ready to start a family, and we're very scared about how we're going to make it work. I have definitely postponed the family planning longer than I probably should have, according to my doctor.
Becky's encouraging her husband to find a better-paying job. And that trend is worrying a lot of employers.
70% of companies say that they're very concerned about losing high-performing employees or employees in key roles.
Ravin Jesuthasan is head of the rewards division at Towers Perrin, a consulting firm. He oversees a survey of about 300 businesses, and the latest edition has some good news. More than half of companies that froze or reduced wages this year say they plan to give raises again in 2010. Jesuthasan says it'll probably be a while before those employees are making what they were before the recession. But if businesses want to hold on to their best workers, he says it's important to have a vision for how to make that happen. Michael Casper had one. He's president of Ultrasource, a ceramic microchip manufacturer in Hollis, New Hampshire. At the beginning of the year, his company's profits fell into the red, and he had to lay off 30 workers. But that wasn't enough. He cut the rest of his employees' pay by 10%, but he did it with an exit plan.
We put a profit goal in front of everybody, and we promised that if we hit a certain profit level, that people would get their 10% back.
That was at the beginning of March. Before April came around, they'd reached their goal.
The product we make is very fragile, as you can imagine. If somebody drops it or if somebody bumps it, it shatters. And we helped people understand that what was acceptable in the past was actually working against us.
So people stopped breaking chips, essentially? Or
they did. We cut our scrap rate in half in a very short period of time.
Like a month?
Like a month, yes.
Casper says he's been trying to minimize that scrap rate for years, so he decided to take this new incentive system a step further. He told the workers that in addition to earning their 10% back, each month they could share a bigger piece of the company's profits.
You know, I have been operating a company for 18 years, and I saw the most dramatic employee enlightenment that I've ever seen.
Now, not only are employees earning back their reduced wages, some months they're making more than they did before the reduction. Ultrasource has had such a rebound, Casper's been able to hire back some of the workers he laid off. He says none of that would have happened without his experimental pay cut. Brian Reed, NPR News.
November brings a nerve-wracking deadline for May's college graduates. It's time to make the first payment on their student loans. But with this year's tough job market, many graduates don't know how they'll come up with the money. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Samantha Green graduated from Indiana University in May with a $50,000 debt, a degree in communications, and a burning desire to start her career in Chicago.
I've had a few job offers, jobs that people are always hiring for is sales.
Most are temporary, minimum wage jobs, says Samantha.
It's just not something that is a good fit for me.
Samantha's job prospects are so poor, her parents are paying part of her rent, the electricity bill, groceries, and now they've also started paying back the student loan Samantha needed to finish school. About $300 a month, says Matt Green, Samantha's dad.
Fortunately, we have some money saved, so we're able to help her, but I think that we have to bring her home and say, look, you know, you need to live under our roof until you're able to get yourself a job. And we knew the job market was tight, but we really didn't expect it would take her this long to secure any kind of employment.
An absolutely dismal job market, experts say, is driving up the student loan default rate. And no one hears more stories about it than Mark Kantrowitz, founder of FinAid.org, a popular website that dispenses student financial aid advice.
Most often I hear from students who have overborrowed for their education and are trying to avoid going into default on their loans.
The current default rate is about 7%, nearly twice what it was in 2006. About a quarter of a million people who were supposed to start paying their student loans back in 2007 have not. And that doesn't include 2009 or 2008 graduates like Gregory Sandana. Sandana, a UCLA graduate, was the first in his family to attend college. His parents couldn't contribute very much money, so he qualified for the maximum amount of federal aid.
I still had to work three jobs throughout my 4 years, and I still ended up with more than $40,000 in loan and credit card debt.
Gregory's salary before taxes today is $35,000 a year. His monthly loan payment, about $350, is not a huge amount, but it doesn't leave very much for him to live on in Washington, D.C., where he's president of the U.S. Student Association.
It's difficult, and I feel like I shouldn't have had to live paycheck to paycheck, and especially with a UCLA degree. I don't have a car. I have the bare minimum when it comes to food. I don't even have cable or any TV.
Gregory says his parents both had to take second jobs to help him because the consequences of going into default are really scary. Your loans are turned over to a collection agency. Your wages can be garnished. The government can withhold your Social Security benefits. And of course, your credit will be ruined. Graduates can defer their loan payments for up to 3 years if they're deemed hardship cases. But there is one other option students have never had before. In July, Congress passed the Income-Based Repayment Plan, which allows graduates to pay back their federal government loans based on what they earned. It limits payments to no more than 15% of a person's monthly income.
It's going to be a great plan for borrowers who are under financial distress.
Again, Mark Kantrowitz of FinAid.org.
the income-based repayment plan will prevent a lot of defaults.
Rule of thumb, says Kantrowitz, borrow less than what you expect to earn right after graduation. So if you go after a bachelor's degree, don't borrow more than $45,000. That's easier said than done for Samantha Green in the Windy City. But Samantha says she has a backup plan.
If I can't find a job, I'm going to apply to grad school.
Which probably means another $50,000 in loans. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.